Hey, everybody, this is Kenny Wayne Shepherd, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hi, this is Ronnie Baker Brooks, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hey, this is Joe Grisecki, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Welcome to episode 542 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host, John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 542 is a jumbo episode with some amazing musicians from the world of blues and R&B and rock. So we're not going to talk too long in between these interviews because this might be a long one. We have joining us leading off Kenny Wayne Shepherd. He's back a second time in as many years. He's talking about Dirt on My Diamond Volume 2. If you're a listener to the show regularly, you recall him being here in 2023 to talk about Dirt on My Diamonds Volume 1. And this is the sequel to that, so it's great to get a chance to catch up to an amazing musician. We get to talk about the new record, and we get to talk a little bit about the iconic Jimi Hendrix Strat from Woodstock on that episode. Interview as well. So we'll get to him in just a moment. And then joining us from Alligator Records, Ronnie Baker Brooks, who is the son of the late Lonnie Brooks, who's in the Blues Hall of Fame. Ronnie is releasing, or has just released, I should say, a brand new album called Blues in My DNA, which couldn't be more aptly titled. His first for Alligator Records, but not his first album. And we get to talk about the record, but also some amazing stories about his time playing in his father's band, growing up with kind of a blues legend milling about the house, and some really great stories. I really enjoyed talking to him. And then finally, a man who needs no introduction in the city of Pittsburgh whatsoever, Mr. Joe Grisecki, joins us to talk about his latest record. So got a jam-packed episode for you, so we're going to cut through the BS and get right to Kenny Wayne Shepherd. Welcome back to Iron City Rocks. We have Kenny Wayne Shepherd on the line. How are you doing, Kenny?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing fantastic. We had a chance to speak to you, I would say, not quite a year ago when Dirt on My Diamonds Volume 1 came out, and you were doing a show here in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and we just had the pleasure of having Volume 2 dropped on us. Can you talk just a little bit about, if I recall correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it's been almost a year. You recorded this series of songs at the same time as those, or were these done in another session?
Yeah, so, well, they were all written in the same writing session.
Okay.
And then most of them were recorded around the same time, but there were still some things that had to be finished up. So
okay.
They were finished up separately. But yeah, originally they kind of all burst out of the same writing session.
Okay.
And mostly out of the same recording session. So that's one of the reasons why I thought, you know, I could release these completely separate from one another and space them out, you know, a year and a half apart, kind
sure.
of a standard deal. But then, you know, I was like, you know, but they are connected and it might be a compelling package, you know, to do them as companion records and do a volume one, volume two kind of thing.
Sure. One of the things I noticed when going through the record, how do you kind of decide where Noah's voice makes it, where your voice kind of comes in? Is it, I mean, he's got such a unique sound to his voice, and your voice obviously very different. I mean, is that obviously gives you a lot of different things creatively, but how do you make that decision?
Well, it's just whatever works best in the studio. I mean, yeah, Noah has an incredible voice, and you know, I'm very fortunate that, you know, I've had him in the band mm-hmm. for so many years, but and as things have evolved and I've started singing more and more, you know, starting on my fourth album back in 2004, mm-hmm. you know, that was the first record I started singing on. But it was like, yeah, we have very, very different voices, and believe it or not, as great of a singer as he is, it's like some some songs that we write and record are better, just better suited for my voice and my approach, and then obviously some are much better suited for his voice and his approach, which is what's great, because if we only had his voice to deal with, then some of these songs wouldn't have made the record, and vice versa. If it was only me singing on my records, then there's some of the songs, other songs wouldn't have made the record because my voice just doesn't fit them.
Yeah, and he's got such a distinct tone to his voice, you know, and I listen to it and I think, okay, I can see why you want to kind of sprinkle that in, you know, with some of the different songs. But it is nice to have that kind of change of pace. You know, think of like a NFL team with two running backs. You know, it's a nice situation to be in. When you're going through these songs, you know, and I listen to the, you know, some of these, I can say, okay, this song, you know, has such a cool guitar riff, and then you have like the brass coming in. When you're doing that, do you get involved, or do you let the musicians kind of chart out where they add the brass to the songs, because it's such an important element to these songs?
Oh yeah, no, I'm involved in every aspect of making my records. That's part of, you know, producing them, and you know, but I'm not the only producer. Like Marshall Altman and I have been co-producing my records going back to the Lay It On Down album, which has been probably four albums ago. But no, what we do is, so like my musicians that I use in the studio and live, for that matter, because it's basically the same people, but I try and surround myself with incredibly talented people who are, you know, the best at their instrument, and so therefore I trust their instinct, number one, right? Like I hire these guys because they know what they're doing with their instrument. Same with the horn guys. So what we do is like, you know, we'll record the songs. The horns are one of the few instruments that always get overdubbed and put on later. So we'll send them the rough mixes of the songs that we cut in the studio, and then we let them come up with their own parts. And then they'll bring the parts into the studio, and then Marshall and I are there producing. And so we'll keep what we like, and we'll adjust things that maybe we think could be slightly different, or maybe even possibly better than what they've come up with. And Marshall's very good. Like, he hears very distinct parts, so he always has a lot of great suggestions. And you know, you're dealing with professional musicians here, so like, nobody's getting their feelings hurt. It's all in whatever is best for the music and the song.
Yeah, it's got to be kind of a unique thing to layer that with a band of this size, because the horns really sonically kind of cut, you know, to the listener's ear. So you kind of have to, you know, I don't want to say put them in their place, but there certainly is a place for them in a mix.
Well, you got to use them strategically, and you got to, like, it's like, you know, this is not a swing band. This is not a jazz band. You know, it's actually a blues and rock and roll band, but sometimes leaning a little more into rock than blues. And so, I mean, that when I started, if you go back to my album from 2011, How I Go, and there's a couple songs on that record that have horns on it. And then, you know, like we did the Lay It On Down record, and I had horns on a couple songs there, and the Going Home record. But like, it wasn't until the Traveler album, which I think came out in 2019, that I was like, you know, we had a lot of rock songs on that record. I mean, Woman Like You, we did a Buffalo Springfield song, we did covered the Joe Walsh song. So there was like some really rocking songs on that record, and I was like, you know, what would it be like to have a horn section on songs that rock this hard, you know? And so we tried it. And then we put the horns on almost every song on that record, and so then I brought the horns out on tour, and it kind of started this cycle that I'm in right now with using the horns heavily on the records, you know, which has kind of created an interesting dynamic.
It does. Yeah. I mean, you've got, you know, it's kind of, you know, when you think of songs with horns, sometimes they're almost more of the focal, but you've got some, you know, really wicked guitar riffs in there with the horns layered in there quite nicely. And it makes a very nice dynamic. You know, I know when I was first going through it, like sometimes I kind of caught myself trying to decide what I was going to listen to the most, you know, because I always, you know, kind of key in on a guitar riff. That's usually where I go first. but I like, okay, this is really kind of a neat dynamic. The one song that to me jumped out was My Guitar Is Crying. Maybe I'm crazy, but I could feel some Hendrix, maybe some Little Wing kind of creeping in. Not so much in the song, but in the tone of the guitar. Was that kind of subconscious or just what fit the song the best?
Yeah, well, no, you're right as far as the tone goes, but it's always about what fits the song best, for sure. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's because on the guitar, especially the rhythm guitar, I'm using a univibe, and that was an effect that Hendrix famously put to good use on a lot of his songs over the years. So you're certainly hearing some of that without a doubt. And, you know, I'm kind of like, I'm a sucker for ballads. I love to write ballads. You know, and this one's not necessarily a love song. It's more of like a, you know, I mean, the guy's kind of like having a really tough time in this song.
Sure.
But it is a ballad, if you will. Like musically, it's slow and it's like a vulnerable moment. And I've just, you know, I grew up in an era of, for better or for worse, you know, in the era of the power ballad, where like all the biggest bands, the hair bands and the rock bands, it's like, you know, some of their biggest songs was the ballad. And so, you know, my generation, I think, really connects with ballads. So, you know, I'm always writing one, whether one winds up on a record or not. I'm always writing them. And this one worked out for this record.
Were you kind of licking your chops to do the solo on that song? I could almost feel it coming like a wave, and it just breathes so perfectly in that song. Was that, do you really enjoy kind of doing the slower tempo songs when it comes to soloing, or is it vary song to song?
Well, every song is different, and you know, the challenge is like to, and it's always been my mentality, is just to play what is right for the song. You know, it's like, I never fell into the trap. And maybe, you know, who knows if it was the best decision to make or not, but it's been it is the decision that I've made. And my approach has always been to play what is most appropriate for the song and not necessarily seeing every song is an opportunity for me to like try and show off on guitar,
right?
You know, and so sometimes that means that it's a more restrained approach, and it's not necessarily the guitar solo that's going to wow all the guitar nerds out there. But like, I'm just trying to play what's best for the song and best for the music in that moment, even if it means that I don't have a standout moment on guitar. You know, it's still what's best for the song.
Yeah,
it's not a distraction.
I think in that case, that song, that solo very much enhances the song, and you're absolutely right. I mean, this isn't something you'd want to pepper with sweeping arpeggios or, you know, tapping. It's kind of what separates that from, you know, the aforementioned hair ballad, is that it wasn't, you know, a solo from out of nowhere. It was just so into that. One question I have to ask, I had seen a picture very recently, and you're out on the Experience Hendrix tour right now, and had an opportunity to play the Strat of Strats, the Isabella Strat. Can you just talk about that moment?
Well, yeah, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, here's the thing. I got to play that guitar 14 years ago. They flew that guitar to New York, and I played it on the Jimmy Fallon show when he was still in New York.
Okay.
And then I played it later that night on stage at the Beacon Theater. So for me, this was a reunion of sorts with this guitar. And it was cool because, like, having done that previously, and I've played a lot of, like, incredibly famous instruments since then as well. So I've kind of gotten comfortable with the idea of what it means to play a guitar of that magnitude, on music like this. So the first time I did it, you know, I played on the Jimmy Fallon show just for the commercial breaks and stuff like that, but then live on stage, because the guitar was set up so differently than how I would set my guitars up, I was worried that maybe I'd be struggling a bit too much, and I didn't want to not do it justice. So I only played it on one song at the Beacon Theater. But like the other night, I played it on like four songs. I'm like, no, this is a moment. We're going to play this thing. You know, we're going to really like, we're going to be in the moment and we're going to enjoy it. And we're going to like really put this instrument through its paces, which I felt like we did. And it was a lot of fun. You know, I said it before, it's like to hold that guitar, just to be in the presence, but like to actually touch that guitar, just to hold it, like it would be like so many guitar players dream. And then to actually play it, and then to play it on stage, and to be playing Hendrix's music on that guitar, and hopefully, you know, doing it well enough to do it justice. I mean, it's like that's so many guitar players.
Yeah, I can think of so few instruments that would raise to that level of hallowed, you know. I can think of maybe two or three, you know, that would really go to the level of Hendrix Woodstock National Anthem guitar. I mean, that's just, you know, that's pretty impressive. It had to be a very special for you to do that. Can you talk just a little bit about, you know, kind of dropping a record while you're out doing a tour for something totally different? I'm sure, you know, you're used to kind of dropping a record and kind of getting ready to hit the road, or maybe you've already done a couple dates, but this one you're off kind of doing a totally different thing at the time. Is it kind of make it a little bit easier to kind of think, you know, you're not watching numbers and downloads and things like that, or?
Well, no, you're paying attention. I mean, we're paying attention. I mean, ultimately, nowadays, you know, for artists such as myself, you know, it's the blues category. It's like, it's not really, you know, the main measure of success is like, are people showing up to see your concerts, you know?
Yeah.
Are the butts in the seats? And that's the real barometer for, I think, nowadays. And we've been on a roll, like, you know, we've been doing really well and selling out like the majority of our shows for several years in a row now. So that's all good. I mean, obviously you want to see people responding and listening to the music, and but really I think this has given us an opportunity for the fans. So we toured this year, we played several songs from the new record from Volume 1. And then just as we were wrapping up our tour to begin the Hendrix tour, we played a couple of the Volume 2 songs just to play them, because we've been rehearsing them in soundcheck. But we played a couple of them live. But this just gives us an opportunity for our fans to hear the music and connect with it and to actually be with the music for a couple of months before we start the tour next year, where we will be featuring songs from Volume 2, so that by that time, they're hearing the songs in the show, and they're actually songs that they're familiar with, which I think will be good, because they've had some time to live with it and to like bond with the music, and then they can go, okay, I know this song, like, you know, and they'll be singing along and what have you.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you take a song, I listen, you know, and listening to this song is like Watch You Go, and I Got a Woman, I could see you dropping instantly into a set list and people being really into right away. But you're absolutely right. Sometimes, it, you know, when you have a couple dozen spins of a song under, you know, in kind of in your brain, it really makes it nice to see it live. So it's a great point. So, Kenny, I don't want to keep any longer up. So you've got a million things going on with the Hendrix tour, but hopefully we'll see you back here in Pennsylvania in 2025. And really looking forward to it. And congratulations on Third of My Diamonds Volume 2, man.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Dirt of My Diamonds Volume 2 is available now from Kenny Wayne Shepherd. I invite you to check that out. And I'm sure it will not be long before we see Kenny Wayne Shepherd back in the Pittsburgh area. He is no stranger. So look forward to seeing his return playing material from both of those records. Really enjoyed Dirt of My Diamonds Volume 2. It's got some stuff that, as I said in the interview, you could hear it once and you would love it in the set. It would just slide in very nicely into his work. So hopefully we get a nice dose of that the next time through. We'll turn our attention now to a blues prodigy, really. A man who literally has blues in his DNA, which is the title of his newest album, his debut on Alligator Records. Mr. Ronnie Baker Brooks, as I mentioned at the top of the show, he's the son of Lonnie Brooks, who is, if you're a blues fan, needs no introduction. Ronnie had played bass for his father for a number of years. We'll get into that in a little bit in the interview. And then decided to go his own route and make his own mark in the blues world. A fabulous vocalist, a great guitarist, a great songwriter, and as you'll find, a great storyteller as well, which I think always makes for a good songwriter. So we're going to play you a little bit of Ronnie Baker Brooks. We'll get right into that interview.
Oh, yeah. By the man above, didn't know we had no money, 'cause we were rich with pure love. Trying to stretch $1 million to last us a whole week. Stomachs was growling, my tears was falling down my mama's cheek. I never felt exempted from the other side of the track. My looks wasn't that privileged, I had to learn to live with that. I'm not complaining, Lord, I'm just explaining. I got the blues in my DNA. Oh yeah. Trouble, trouble, trouble. Living life with despair. I came a long, long way just to get right, yeah. The hustle is on in streets, y'all, of my neighborhood. Corrupt politicians and crooked cops, all up to no good. Paranoia got my head on a swivel as the bills keep stacking tall. I'm trying my best to stay legit, y'all, with anxiety pitfalls. I'm not complaining, Lord, I'm just explaining. I got the blues in my DNA. Yeah, my grandma and grandpa had them, my mama and daddy too. I can feel the pain from the chains of what my ancestors been through. Lord, please purify this blood running through my veins. Of the blues in my DNA. Oh yeah. Every day has been a blessing. This life I live, the blues has been a lesson to turn bad into a positive. It's gotta get better, y'all, with self-accountability. Reverse the curse that's been casted on me and my family. I'm gonna look into the mirror with this love from this healing. Keeping the faith with every piece I break of this invisible glass ceiling. I'm not complaining, Lord, I'm just explaining. I got the blues in my DNA. I'm not victim blaming, Lord, I'm just explaining. I got the blues in my DNA. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Iron City Rocks. We have on the line Ronnie Baker Brooks. How are we doing today, Ronnie?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. You've got a fantastic new album out. Just got a chance to give it a listen over the weekend. Blues in My DNA, which is very exciting. I think a really a monumental record in what could be, I think, quite a trajectory for your career. Even though you're no stranger to this, this isn't your first album. You've been playing music probably almost as since you were old enough to hold the guitar, in fact, the bass. Can you talk a little bit? I know your father is obviously Lonnie Brooks, for name that doesn't need any introduction to our audience, but kind of what drew you in? You know, I think if you know, a lot of parents are into music and, you know, their kids want to listen to anything but what they listen to. You know, I know for years I tried to get my kids into certain kinds of music and they went in a totally different direction and they do their own thing. But what kind of got you to come around to dad's style of music? And can you talk a little bit about how that education kind of springboarded your own career?
Well, you know, initially the whole thing started for me just wanting to be around my dad. Mm-hmm. I just loved to be around him, and it was just he made it fun around the house. You know, my dad was a little kid within, a grown man and man, you know, with a kid's heart, and he would actually get on the floor and play with us, play board games with us, you know, just keeping the family atmosphere fun, man, and of course, with a lot of music. And whenever he picked up his guitar to play, I just wanted to sit around and be around him. And it just rubbed off of me. I remember hearing, you know, some of the music he was playing, and I gravitated to it. I started to like it, even as a child, you know. And remember hearing it on the radio when he wasn't around, you know, some of the stuff he was learning. Because at the time, he was doing a lot of... at that time, you know, disco came in when I was old enough to understand what he was doing. Disco came in and it kind of knocked the blues out a little bit.
Sure.
So dad had to play whatever was on the top 40 list, you know, at the time to keep a gig, you know. So we were listening to everything from country music, blues, rock and roll, soul, gospel, everything. And dad was always inclusive. And initially, it just started like that. I wanted to be around him, and he would always say, if you like what I like or do what I do, you get my full attention, and that's what I did.
Was it helpful in a way that you know, when you guys were in Chicago, which is obviously, you know, your father was born in Louisiana, but you guys moved up there. Well, actually, he moved there before you were born. Was it helpful to be in that city where he didn't have to be on a bus 11 months out of the year for you? Or did you get a lot of home time with him, or was he gone a lot as a kid?
You know, John, it worked out just right for me. When I was much younger, dad career was kind of, like I said, in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. He got to deal with capital. He was with Capitol Records, and then that fell through. That didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
The record came out, but then for what he told me, the new president came in, and he was up under a vice president, and the new president brought in a new vice president, and they dropped everybody that old vice president had, and that was including my dad under that umbrella. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that record is called Broken, I'm Hungry. On Capitol Records, I believe, is one of the only blues records that was on Capitol. So dad career was kind of in a stall.
Yeah.
And so he was doing a lot of gigs around Chicago.
Right.
And so that allowed him to be home more. And then, you know, when he got with Alligator Records, by that time I was a little older.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that time with dad.
Yeah.
You know, when he got out, he started, you know, traveling a lot more then, you know, around the country, around the world. And so I got that time in as, you know, the crucial age, you know, from a toddler to like, you know, 10 years old, that where I had that personal time with Dad. You know, during the daytime, he would babysit us and gig that night. And then he finally got a day job where he would do the day job, and then he'd go to his night gigs on the weekends. So we had time with Dad at that age. But then once I got to a teenager, he started allowing me to go on the road with him. You know, and so it worked out as far as that goes. And a lot of the time that I spent with him later in my later, you know, part of my life, it was on the road. And I'll never forget, we were in Australia somewhere, and he asked me to come up to his room, and he's like, "Son, I'm so glad you're out here with me now. I feel like I'm at home."
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we had a home on the road.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, you guys were, you know, you think of an artist when, you know, things happen with labels and, you know, musical styles shift, or even COVID. You know, you feel bad for a musician in a way, because, you know, I mean, it's how you make your livelihood. But you guys really kind of got a blessing in disguise there, you know, to be able to have that time, you know, with you as a young man in those formative years, like you said, and then to go out on the road. I can't imagine that, you know, the places you got to see together and how much more special that would have been.
You know, man, I didn't understand the impact that my dad had on the music and amongst his friends and all that as well, because I really just, like I said, wanted to be around him.
Yeah.
But the story I would like people to understand a little more. A lot of them know him as a musician, this great musician that, you know, recorded some good music. He was a great father.
Yeah.
He was a great man. You know, of course, we all have mistakes that we did, you know, as we were young. But Dad had a huge heart. He loved people, all colors, all ages. He loved people, man. I remember we be on the road and we stop at a truck stop and to get some fuel, and I literally have to go in there and pull Dad out of the store, man, because Dad, we got a sound check to make, man, because he's in there talking at the counter, man, telling stories, and you know, and people gravitated to him. They didn't know he was a musician a lot of times.
Yeah, just a good guy.
So he had this kind of aura around him, man, and it was just like that at home. You know, it just amplified on stage, and I didn't understand how blessed I was to be able to share that with him now that he's not here anymore. You know, like being on stage with your father, man, and we both doing what we love to do, along with my brother as well. Man, I really cherish that even more. Now, I knew it was special. I didn't know how special it was, you know, the whole thing, how much it means, like I do now, but I really, really feel blessed to have those moments.
Yeah, and it is one of those ironies in life that you don't necessarily realize how good you have it until it's over. You know, I mean, it's millions of songs written about that theme alone, but it is the truth.
You know, when you're doing it at that time, when I was doing it, I was young, much younger. I'm thinking it's gonna last forever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not thinking about when I get older or whatever. I was in the moment, man. Just probably too much in the moment, and you think it's gonna last forever, and then all of a sudden it's gone. Yeah. And he's like, wow, how can I go back to that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at least you have the recordings, you have the times, you know, a lot of things you can kind of go back as, you know, kind of keepsakes of that time, which is wonderful, but such a blessing. So the new album, not to dwell too much in the past, but the new album, can you talk a little bit about these particular songs? Were these things you had kind of, you know, written through the years, or was this, you know, a thing that you sat down, you know, to write for this specific album?
You know, I'm always writing. I try to keep that going, because you're always going to need songs. You're always going to need something new, and I like to be inspired by something fresh, you know, and look forward to playing, you know, because of course I can play all of my songs forever now that's been recorded and released, but you know, just keeping something fresh and current for me to stay in the moment that I'm the present that I'm in. And so I could always write. And during the pandemic, I had time, you know, a lot of time to write even more. And I was doing a Facebook Live show every Friday during the pandemic, it just happened because I was sitting around like wondering what the heck was going to happen.
And
I said, well, you know, maybe I should go live on Facebook. And the first time I did it, man, I think I was on there for like 3 or 4 hours playing.
Doing an Allman Brothers set.
Yeah, you know, and I said, wait, my wife was like, wait a minute, that's a little too much. And I said, so it gave me inspiration to write new stuff because I wanted to have something new to present to the people or something, you know, fresh. And I just wrote as much as I could. And when it was time to do this record, we agreed to do this record with Alligator. I presented 30 songs. And we had to pick, you know, some of them was already pre-recorded.
Sure.
I've done sessions with Big Head Todd. You know, that's my brother, my brother's man, Big Head Todd and the Monsters.
Yeah.
I had written some songs with him, and then he co-produced a record with me, acoustic record, that we were planning on putting out during the pandemic. And then I worked with some songs with Kev Mo that we hadn't released. And so I presented those along with the new ones I had. And we picked the best we thought fit the concept. You know, Bruce has Alligator has a brand that they're used to that they have. And so we tried to, you know, make all of these songs fit within that, along with me being myself and not trying to force a circle into a square thing.
Sure.
So it worked out that way, but that was one of the toughest things to do, John, because I love all my songs. Like, when I write them, I put all of me in it, and it's hard to let them go, you know, or leave them behind or whatever. You know, that's a thing I'm trying to learn to deal with and grow out of. But that was one of the challenges for this record, was which ones not to record, and then once I recorded, which ones to put on the record, and then what sequence. So it's a process.
Yeah, it's probably better than sitting with 6 songs struggling to come up with the inspiration for 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever, to have too many. But yeah, it is, you know, like, it's like, which kid are you going to leave behind when you go on vacation, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's probably not an easy thing.
That's what my dad always said. I didn't mean to cut you off, but that's what my dad always said. Write, because you're going to always need songs.
Yeah.
So always continue to write, so you don't be in that predicament of, man, I got 6, I need 7. You know what I mean? If you got, and in some cases too, you can have 10. They're not strong as the 1 or the 2 or 3. So it's always good to continue writing, because you never know what you may use later.
Yeah.
And like my first 3 records on my own label, Watchdog Records, Gold Digger, the first record, Gold Digger, mm-hmm. I wrote 15 songs for that one. We put out 12. For my second album, Take Me With You, we put out 15. I wrote 21 songs for that one. And then The Torch, we put out 17 songs on one album. And I had wrote 25 for that, man. And we cut all of this stuff. We cut all of them. Whereas with this record, we only recorded like 12 or 13, you know, because of, you know, we didn't want to, you know, waste the time in the studio with the musicians. Not waste the time, but we didn't have the time, you know what I'm saying?
Do you go back to those songs at any point, you know, when you're looking for, okay, let's say, you know, when Blues Is in My DNA 2 comes out, do you make a habit of going back to those old songs and seeing if any of them maybe fit or could be retooled, or once you're done with them, they just go on the shelf?
Most of the time they just go on the shelf, but some of them I do review just in case if it fits something that we're trying to go after.
Okay.
A topic or a style, or, you know, something I really feel like could fit what we're doing at the moment. But most of the time I try to stay fresh and, you know, write about where I'm at that time in my life.
You touched on something that I was always curious about with the Facebook Live shows, because they were pretty common at the time. You know, you would see some relatively massive bands doing, you know, these kind of special one-off pay-per-view things, but the actual, like, Facebook Live, like just set up the camera and play from your heart kind of stuff. Was that surreal playing, knowing there's an audience out there, but you really can't read them? I mean, I guess you could try to watch the comments go by or maybe have somebody with you to read some comments. But what was that experience like as somebody who you grew up on a stage, truly grew up on a stage? What was that like?
It was kind of weird at first, to be honest with you, because you're so used to a response back. Mm-hmm. You know, like either yay or nay, something.
Yeah, anything. You know,
and it wasn't. It was dry. But then when I start thinking about, like, listening to live records when I was a kid, mm-hmm. wanting to be there in the room when they were cutting that song, or wanting to be in the venue when it was recording a live record, that's what I tuned into for me. Like on the other side, being the one performing the song, I wanted them to feel the experience as if they're in the room with me. Like I used to do when I remember talking to Todd about this, Todd Parkmore from Big Head Todd, mm-hmm. like wanting to be in the room. And you create this environment so thick, this vibe so thick, where people are like, man, I wish I was there with them, or, you know, what it felt like, you know, and that for me was digging into the song and just being transparent as possible, man. Just opening your heart, man. And I remember talking to Robert Cray about this. It's like when you're writing songs, I think Robert Cray is one of the greatest of all time, in my opinion, man. Songwriter, performer, guitarist, singer. Oh, my God.
He's a total package,
He is, man. He is. He's one of my favorites of all time. And I remember talking to him about this, like writing songs. And he was like, yeah, the hardest part is learning how to open your heart and let this stuff out. It gets even harder once you know how to do that, to close it and get off the stage.
Yeah.
Now you got to walk back to reality.
Yeah.
And doing those Facebook Live shows, I just opened it up, man, and just I tried my best to make people feel like they were right here in my home with me.
Did you do a lot of, like, storytelling in between songs, or was it just set up and play?
I told stories, you know, and then eventually I started having guests come in, and I would interview them. You know, the one person I wish I could have had, though, man, during that time was my dad, man. And unfortunately, he had passed. But I had my wife. I had my sisters come in. I had my mother on her birthday. I my mom would tell stories, man, about when, you know, she was dating my dad, how they met. And then when I was born, and how she was best friends with Buddy Guy's wife, and how they were hanging out, and when I came home from the hospital, she helped take care of me, and her and Buddy would help take care of the house, whatever my mom needed, because they were friends. They all lived in the same building. Mm-hmm. And all of these stories that I didn't know.
That's gold, yeah.
I would bring in some of my friends, man, and then most of the time it was just me and the guitar, and I would do tributes to my dad, like on certain days, on his birthday, we have a Lonnie Brooks Day here in Chicago, and I just do a whole show of dad stuff, telling stories, you know?
Yeah, I'm hoping somehow you got recordings of these to keep for your own sake, you know? This is the kind of stuff that I'm sure someday your family will treasure. You know, as much stuff from your dad as you have, that, you know, when you talked about your mom telling stories, that's the kind of thing that, you know, someday, you know, somebody in your family is just going to absolutely want that. That's a beautiful thing to keep.
Yeah. And my father was like that. Like, he would always I remember we did a tour with B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Eric Johnson, Coco Taylor, and Junior Wells, and I was playing behind Dad, Coco Taylor, and Junior. We were the Alligator All-Stars. Mm-hmm. This is back in 1993. Mm-hmm. And my dad bought a camera, man, a video camera, and he was taking footage and stuff, man, and he just gave it to me, here, go for it, you know. And I started taking footage of people talking on the bus, or, you know, just talking, you know, stuff like that. And Dad was always ahead of his time, that kind of stuff, and I think I kind of got that you know, inspiration from him.
Yeah, I'm thinking that there's some money to be made transferring those to streaming or DVD or something. People would love to see that kind of stuff. You know, even just in 1993, Eric Johnson, you know, he was a force in that era. He still is, but that's an amazing tour. So it would be fantastic.
I got to jam with him, man. I got to be on stage with that cat, man. And the cool thing about Eric, he would be watching you. as great as a guitar player he is, he was so interested in what everybody else was doing as well.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of I was on that tour. And I never forget when we were in Miami doing that tour, I was watching BB, Eric, and Buddy, everybody every night. As soon as we were done, I'd go inside watching everybody's show, just taking notes. And, and BB King was watching me, man. Watch him.
Oh.
He called his name at the end of the night. How about it for BB King? And he's walking off the stage, and I'm standing by the sound. I'm sitting by the soundboard or the monitor mixer, and he pointed to me, "Come in." I mean, it's like a movie scene, man. He's walking off the stage, a thousand people screaming his name, and he puts me under his arm, and we're walking off the stage. He said, "Son, I wish I had something like this when I was your age. Learn all you can from all of us.
Yeah.
But I want you to know your daddy's just as good as me or better." And man, I was floating.
Yeah.
BB King said that about my dad.
Yeah. I mean, that's as close as you're going to get it to God coming down and you know, putting his hand on you there, man. So it's amazing stuff. Well, Ronnie, I want to thank you. I don't want to keep you all day. I know you've got a million things to do to get ready for the cruise you guys are going to be performing on. And then you've got a kind of a quick one-off show in Denmark. And then you'll be back over here in Pittsburgh to do a show. So we can't wait to see you on the 13th. Blues Is In My DNA is available now. It's been out for about 10 days now. And we'll make sure we get a copy and get yourself all acquainted with the songs. And we'll look forward to seeing you when you get here, man.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. And thank you, audience, for keeping this music alive. And thank you for all you do for the music. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in Pittsburgh.
All right, Ronnie Baker Brooks. He will be in Pittsburgh to do a show at the original Pittsburgh Winery, which is in the Strip District, on November 13th. We will have a link to tickets on our website. Very affordable night out. Really cool venue. The new album, Blues in My DNA, is available now. Suggest maybe you stream it while you can, and then pick up a copy of it at the show. Always helps the artist when you pick up those physical copies. Head out to the show, support the blues here in Pittsburgh, bring great artists like that back. All right, we're going to turn our attention now to another man who needs no introduction in Pittsburgh, a man who has a new album that came out earlier this summer. The album is called Cannot Run a Memory. He also had an anthology of the Iron City House Rockers. The album is called House Rockers, a Joe Krasheki Anthology. That's available now as well, so they're both out there for your holiday shopping if you haven't picked up something for your favorite music fan. Some fantastic stuff. Just was designated as the coolest song ever, which is a designation Little Stevens Underground Garage does to, I believe it's a song every week, the song This Is Who We Are. Was given that designation, which is a really cool stamp of approval from a longtime friend of Joe's. Joe also talks to us about, you know, how's the songwriting process evolved through the years? Where did the inspiration come from? You know, that, you know, at this stage of your career, where do you get new ideas? How do you capture them? There's a lot of fun insight into the mind of a man who has created so many great records over the years. So without further ado, this is Who We Are from Joe Krasheki and the House Rockers. We'll get into that interview. We'll be right back.
be left in peace. Well, kiss my kids goodnight. I pray things gonna be alright. This is who we are. This is how we roll.
City Rocks. We have Joe Grishecki on the line. How you doing, Joe?
Great. Great.
It's a pleasure to have you back.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a little, we're a little late to the party. You had a new album come out this summer. Cannot Run a Memory. Fantastic record. Really very, I love the authenticity of the songs. And you were just bestowed quite an honor by Little Steven's Underground Garage for having the coolest song in the world for This Is Who We Are. Can you talk a little bit about this particular collection of songs? It had been a number of, well, I don't want to say a number of years as music goes anymore, but you had a little bit of a hiatus from new material. Can you talk a little bit about how these songs took shape?
Yeah, we started working a few years ago, you know, just preparing, writing. We took a little break because of the pandemic, and some people had health problems within the band. So, but once we got started on it, we were focused on what happened writing wise was I think the first song I wrote actually was This Is Who We Are, sort of a statement of where I was at that particular time of day. You know, it's one of those songs that just sort of popped into my head. I had a guitar. I put it down on tape so I wouldn't forget it. And then I start, when we started writing the record, started looking at a thread from where I am today to how did I get here. Mm-hmm. And basically this journey, the journey actually started with the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show, but I took a hiatus a couple of years. We were just talking about the Mon Valley to go to school to TLU. And for all a bunch of different reasons, had to give up playing for a couple of years. And in 1968, I spent the summer in Atlantic City, bought my first Telecaster, and swore I was never going to quit playing again. And so the record is a collection of songs that describe or detail my journey from 1968 to the present day, and talking about music and cultural events and how our particular region of the world has changed a bit and what it's like now.
Yeah, I think the thing that I like about lyrically, you know, you listen to a song like Here in 68 in particular, these songs feel like you just talking about life. And it's, you listen to some musicians at, you know, different stages in their career still try to sound like they're 26, you know, or 18 writing songs. Your songs just feel like they're still coming from where you're at. And I think that makes them quite identifiable with the listener. You know, if you really sit down and listen to the lyrics, you know, obviously people enjoy your style of music, but you're not writing this like you're a teenager.
My style writing is rooted in reality. You know, I have to live the songs a bit, you know, live the life that I'm writing about, to talk about it with any kind of authenticity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been one of the keys to our longevity is that, you know, our records are pretty truthful. And if you listen to the anthology, you know, the vast majority of the songs have sounded like they could have been recorded yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, it's free of gimmicks. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, some of the same identifiable problems that we've had and events going on in the world. So I've always written from a point of view of what I've lived a little bit and what I know.
Yeah, and I think everybody who's, you know, really ever walked this earth realizes there's never a shortage of things to think about and in your case write about. But you made a great point there when you said, you know, about the recording of the songs and how they're free of gimmicks. You know, aside from, you know, frankly, compression on records, a lot of this does have a very similar style. You know, I was just talking to Southside Johnny a few weeks ago, and I think the same thing of his music. When you listen to it, it's like, this is the same beautiful stuff that was coming out of our speaker in 1979. It's just a little more compressed now, a little more spit and polish on it. But, you know, it's still true to what you guys do, which is wonderful.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm buddies with Southside, and you know, he's a keeper of the flame. You know, mm-hmm. the Jersey guys, you know, Northern New Jersey, where I hang out a lot, is just just a beacon of music, man. Yeah. Everybody loves music. Like, sports is the thing here in Western Pennsylvania, music is the thing in Northern New Jersey around Asbury. And there's just one incredible band and a great musician after another there. So it's no surprise that Southside sounds like that. You know, I think people growing up in a certain era look to that music in a certain way and, you know, try to make their own version mm-hmm. of all the great songs that we heard growing up. At least that's what inspired me. You know, I just, you know, I wanted to emulate my idols, boyhood yeah. idols when I started.
Absolutely.
But put my own spin on it.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, when I listen to a record of yours, I don't necessarily, I mean, you can feel some commonalities, but I think it's certainly stylistically very, very you, which is important. When you put your lyrics down, I mean, because music is one thing, lyrics sometimes can steer the ship, though. Do you kind of keep a notebook or something on your phone to come when you come up with ideas for things, you know, as you go through your day-to-day life? You know,
both. Both. You know, in the era of the cell phone, I have this little recording app on my phone, and I probably have 60 or 80 songs or starts of songs or ideas, or now if I'm driving in the car, before I used to pull over and write it down, I'd pull out the phone and sing it into the phone or talk it into the phone or say the lyrics into the phone. And it's sometimes I get home, I either write them out and or put them on the computer. I'm probably one of the world's worst typers. I prefer to write. But so that is one thing that has been very convenient, because I used to go through all kind of little old tape recorders trying to keep my ideas from floating away. But now I just put it on my phone. So I do use it. Once I started this new record, I was listening the other day, probably the first 20 or 30 things I have on the phone are from the new record we did.
Is it kind of fun to go back?
I used it right from the start.
Kind of fun to go back and listen to some of those little, you're stuck in traffic on the parkway or something, and you throw, just listen to what you were singing into the phone versus, what turned out to be Who's Fooling Who or something like that. Do you ever go back and do that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, when I'm starting to write again for write. Mm-hmm. And then I go back and say, oh, did I do anything good here? Is there anything worth saving? Or sometimes I don't even know what the hell I was singing or talking about. So it's a convenient way to save ideas.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Are you a...
I was going to say, and when I get a more fully formed idea, I just sing it into the phone with my guitar. And it serves as a very handy demo. Exchanged ideas that we did in the studio and sent stuff to my band just from me playing guitar onto my phone. So,
are you a? Would you say you're more of a lyricist first? I mean, in the process, something? You get an idea for a song like "Living in Coal Country," for example, and then you stem the lyrics from there, or do you kind of work out some chords and then try to write a melody that kind of fits in there and then see where the lyrics fit the melody? Or how do you tend to approach?
Well, at this point, it's always better and easier when a song just presents itself. Mm-hmm. The last week I wrote two new songs, and they just popped into my head, thankfully, and that's probably the easiest way. And then, of course, I work on refining them, rewriting, editing, all that kind of stuff that you do in a writing process. But there's no set particular way. I do believe, though, the easiest way is when you have a lyrical idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's always great, there's numerous songs in my catalog that all just came together all at once, or most of it, the meat of the song. And there's like Coal Country, you mentioned Coal Country. I had the lyrics done before I did the music on that one. This Is Who We Are came all at once. Who's Fooling Who's main idea of the song came. I find it the key to me is having something to write about.
Yeah,
having an idea that I can expand upon. just getting what I want to write about.
Do you tend to bounce like a song? you know, like when you get it to the form of, okay, I've got kind of a chord progression, I've got the lyrics, I've got a melody. Do you have somebody in the band, or do you work with Rick, or you know, it's kind of a, you know, check my thinking, is this good, or are you at the point now where you just know?
Well, I know when I write a good song, but when I go to record a song, you know, it's a group process.
Mm-hmm.
It's a team sport recording with us anyways, Joe Grushecki and the House Rocker record. I usually bounce the stuff. Lately, I've been bouncing the stuff off my son first, because he has a really good ear, and he's brutally honest.
Yeah. Sons can do that, can't they?
The record we had out. Yeah. The record we had out before, More Yesterdays Than Tomorrows, I was working on a project, and for some reason, I had followed a couple of my friends' advice. I said, why don't you record a blues album? So I started thinking I'm going to record a blues album. And then about halfway through it, I thought, well, you know, doing all these covers is not really floating my boat. It's mm-hmm. making me excited. And I didn't feel like I was doing anything worth listening to. And then I got excited about it. Blah, blah, blah. So I went back and forth, and my son came into my office / listening room, and you know, he says, hey, Dad, how's that new record you're just going to have? I was playing it. And I said, man, it's really good now. Yeah, I'm really happy with it. And he says, well, I got news for you. It sucks. He said, it's the worst thing you ever did. You know, I said, whoa, my God. And so actually, it kicked me in the ass to write some new songs. So I completely revamped the whole record. And he started to get more involved in mm-hmm. the producing and such at that point. With this new record, he and Rick and the guys in the band, usually, you know, I don't really try to guide them with a heavy hand. I just let them, you know, I present the songs to them, and they all sort of do what they think feels best and what's good for them on the song. So you know, it's a team sport, so I am very open to suggestions. You know, I don't think everything I write is you know, the Constitution of the United States or the Bible that can't mm-hmm. be changed. So I've learned that along the way. There's always room for improvement.
Has there been a song along the way that you had less faith in, that maybe the guys, you know, kind of talked you into pursuing more, that you ended up, you know, really liking?
The opposite is true with me. Sometimes I wish I'd have left a couple songs off and come up with a better song.
Mm-hmm.
I never, most, you know, egotistical to say this, but you know, if I didn't like him, I wouldn't put him on the record.
Yeah, man, that's a great point. I mean, you've got to be your own harshest critic. So certainly understand that. Well, Joe, I want to thank
you. Right, and the guys are pretty honest, and you could tell, you know, you could tell sometimes. You know, there's a few things when I listen to it now when I wish I'd have been a little bit more critical myself, and or band and or, you know, the songs. But generally speaking, I think that when we did the anthology, we went back through my catalog, and mm-hmm. most of it holds up pretty well. There's a few spots that aren't my favorites, but you know, I think most of the stuff is really good.
Yeah, see, now you have the ability. You just keep it out of the set list, keep it off the anthology. You can, you're your own man now, you know, and it's. Probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, if I played all, I can't play them all, you know. I got like probably 200 songs recorded and another 100 or so sitting on either on tape or computer or cassettes, you know, that I haven't used. So, you know, material is not a problem at this point.
yeah, exactly. And you've always got that blues album in the bag if you really get time to get tight and you need to make a few bucks.
Yeah, I think that project dead and gone. Yeah, that was a bad idea.
Well, it can't all be platinum.
Well, though I love the blues, though. Yeah. I love the blues. Every time I get disenfranchised or not thinking about disappointed in the current state of music, I start listening to blues real heavy. I just listen to Muddy Waters a lot the last couple of days.
Yeah.
And that's always inspiring because, the blues guys and the jazz guys, they played until they couldn't play anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's what the rock and roll forefathers are doing now. They're just, keeping that type of music alive because, like you said before, it's not just for young guys anymore. It's not a teenage thing.
No, not at all. Joe, I want to thank you so much again. The new album, Can't Outrun a Memory, is available now. It's been out for a few months now. The anthology, also available. We'll have links for both of those. And hopefully we'll be seeing you doing some live stuff pretty soon. And look forward to whatever you're cooking up on the phone next.
All right, man.
All right, a big thank you again to Joe Grushecki. The new album is available now. The anthology is available now. And as always, I appreciate his time gracing our show. I want to also thank Ronnie Baker Brooks, who will be in town on the 13th of November to do his show. And also be remiss not to thank Kenny Wayne Shepherd again. Dirt of My Diamonds Volume 2 is available now. Blink your eye and Kenny Wayne Shepherd will be back in town in some fashion or another. He's never misses Pittsburgh, which is fantastic because I think the fans really love his music. So three amazing musicians. Thank you all for staying with us this whole time. This is a pretty long episode, but we appreciate you making it to the end. You can visit us at ironcityrocks.com. We'll have links to all the stuff we talked about on the show. Also, you can drop us an email, ironcityrocks@gmail.com. Let us know things you enjoy about the show, things you don't like about the show. And we are on all the social medias as Iron City Rocks. Until next time, I want to thank you so much for listening.